Is there a particular moment, the biggest moment of your life, a place that you want to start, Sean?
Perhaps the most monumentous decision I made was on Oldham Road, Manchester, back when I was a uni graduate, and I chose that first ecstasy pill and that rap of speed.
Yeah.
Because that put me on that path then that completely transformed my life.
In what way?
Well, the road of drug use is a very long one, and I got so deep into it that I ended up dealing and running an ecstasy organization that had like 200 people working for me, and, you know, multi-million dollar international thing out of America that then invited the SWAT team to smash my door down and me to wind up in the most brutal jail in America, where not only were the gang members like the neo-Nazi Aryan Brotherhood murdering the prisoners, even the guards were murdering mentally ill prisoners. And that forced me to go deep inside myself, address the root causes of why I'd gone so wild, and try and become a better member of society.
Whether it's money, whether it's drugs, whether it's the fame, or whether it's the greed, there are so many reasons as to why we do what we do in our life. And I suppose that's exactly what our guest on today's episode has pondered over for, well, the last few decades, really, of his. Spending time behind bars wasn't exactly on his life plan or the route to success, but that's what happened to Sean Atwood. To the outside eye, he looks like a fairly tall guy, bald head and from Widnes, with a slight Scouse accent. But his story is completely different. This is the Fuck It Moments podcast. On this particular podcast, we face the truth as to some of the choices we have to make in life, whether ones that we've chosen ourselves or have been chosen for us, and the routes and the things that we would do if we were to look back in hindsight. But today's story is open to suggestions that here's a bad boy who took a couple of bad decisions, made some mistakes along the way, and is now trying to do good in society and restore his karma. I will give you the warning, though, that this does contain some pretty graphic and wild description. So if you have children or you have someone who's fairly sensitive, I would suggest that, where possible, pop your headphones on and listen to this in private. Otherwise, let's get the show on the road and start talking about the moments which make us all human, for good and for bad. We start off talking about his regrets and whether he has any. And what does he say to school kids when they ask if he'd go back and change anything in his life?
All right, so the school kids ask me would I do it over again. And I say yes and no. I say no because of the harm I saw drugs cause to society in the jail. The guys shooting up heroin, the crystal meth, 2/3 hepatitis C, yellow jaundice, skin, teeth rotting out. You know, and I was like, I put people on that road. So I felt bad. The harm that I caused my parents and my sister. Mum had a nervous breakdown. Sister had to have counselling. But then again, I say to the kids, I would do it again because I had to go through it all to mature as a person and to learn certain life lessons. And it's what's brought me here today to your school. And, you know, I do yoga, believe in karma, and I get all this feedback from the kids, and it's very positive. So it makes my heart think I've been led in this right direction.
Mm. Do you think along the way, you know, you kind of say about that first rap, and there are so many people who at that time in Manchester would have taken drugs at that time.
Yeah.
But what was that particular, was there even a moment, so to speak, where you went from being a drug taker to a drug dealer?
All right. If you want the complete trajectory of my drug history, we've got to go back to the root cause of you know, why I started taking drugs in the first place, why I got so deep into it. And when I was a teenager, I just passed my mum's, my driver's license test, went to fill up my mum's little red car with petrol, and some drunk started behaving abusively towards me, and I thought it was brave to stand up to them. But it was a mistake. They got me on the floor, started kicking me in the head. All I could do was curl up in the fetal position. One pulls out an iron bar, smashes me in the face, knocking pieces of my teeth out. My whole body went warm and numb. I started seeing stars, and they basically left me for dead. I hadn't died. I thought I was dying, but I just went unconscious. So I had normal anxiety as a teenager, which was then compounded by almost getting beaten to death by these guys. Won't go up and dance, won't go up and talk to women. I was too self-conscious. As soon as the rave scene started in this country, I took that rap of speed, took an ecstasy pill, wouldn't stop dancing all night long, wouldn't stop hugging people, making friends, and I was the complete life and soul of the party. But for then, for over 10 years, I didn't think I was an interesting enough person to be around unless I was high. Inside, I was still this anxious person, but nobody could see that because I was running around and doing all these crazy things. And as you get deep into that lifestyle, you're always chasing those early highs, but they don't. You never can quite get that. So you get into mixing your drugs up, you get into doing more drugs, and it's just a slippery slope. And it got to the point where I'm thinking, do I want to be working the stock market, waking up at 5 in the morning, going to my job? Or I can just start selling ecstasy, make money from the party scene, get high, have fun. And, you know, all these selfish reasons just made me abandon the normal path people have, you know, in the work world, and become this full-time ecstasy dealer.
So you talk as well, you mentioned there about being a stockbroker.
Yeah.
And you went on to make millions just being a stockbroker. It was a pretty crazy journey to get there. I think I remember you saying in your book about just living off bananas and water. And what was it? Put cups of tea or something, bananas, and there was something else, wasn't there?
Oh, when I first started in the stock market, it was commission only, and I wasn't much good at it. Wasn't generating any new clients.
Yeah.
And I was running out of money on my student credit cards, just, you know, I've been in America only like a year or so. And I was down to living off cheese on toast and bananas at
that
point.
Cheese on toast. So British.
Worried I was going to have to come home. But
do you have to be a certain type of person to go and be a stockbroker? Is there something within your personality, I suppose, that's chasing those highs?
I think in terms of the stockbroker stuff, if you've seen Wolf of Wall Street, then you know it's just glorified telesales. It's just a case of getting on the phone and dialing those numbers, 500 numbers a day I had to call, and getting used to all the rejection and just getting a few clients and building it up. So it's formulaic, actually. They use all this fancy language, you know. It's like learning a foreign language, like language of finance almost. But the bottom line is, it's just glorified telesales. Mm. Yeah.
So you know, we've kind of skipped the major part, really, I suppose, of how you've come to tell this, that you were eventually arrested, you were taken into prison, and it wasn't just any ordinary type of prison, was it? When you walked through the doors and kind of saw what you were faced with for the next 6 years, it was pretty shocking. And there must have been moments when you walked through that door thinking, OK, things are really about to change. Everything, the reality of what you'd led before happened.
It wasn't my brightest idea to break the law, where as soon as you go in, neo-Nazis from the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang come up to you, and basically these guys decide who lives or dies. And the first thing they want to know is what your charges are. Now, I'm new to this game. I've got my charge sheet. It's all this legal terminology. I haven't got a clue what it means. So I say, I'm not sure what my charges mean. They didn't like that at all. And they're like, they got me in the cell trapped. Now they've got me up against the wall. They're like, what do you mean you don't know what your charges mean? Are you a chomo? Are you a chomo? I don't know what a chomo is either, but chomo's child molester.
Yeah,
they think I've got something to hide because I won't say what my charges are.
Mm.
So some charges are KOS, kill on sight right away, paedophile stuff, crimes against women or kids. Some charges are SOS, smash on sight, just beat up. such as drive-by shootings, because women and kids sometimes get hit. So anyone coming in with a sex offence, crime against a woman or a child, they're going to get at least beaten up right away or possibly murdered. Once you get through that interrogation, and I showed them my charge sheet in the end, they saw I was in for drugs. Nearly everyone's in prison for drugs. My bail was $750,000. They loved that. They were like, God damn, who did you kill? And all this stuff. And I was like, no, we were just doing ecstasy. And then you got to go, they explain all the rules. So if someone calls you a punk, a bitch, or hits you, you must fight them on the spot. That's whole gang will smash you. Must take showers, smash you for bad hygiene. Can't go make your friends with the guards, they'll smash you for snitching. Can't go sit at the table with other races, they'll smash you for that. And they're constantly looking for people to beat up, because that's how they earn their reputations and their tattoos. There was a case in Manchester a few years back where they're copying this prison lifestyle out of America now, where this young person went out and murdered someone and he got the teardrop tattoo.
Yeah.
Wasn't the brightest idea to think. It wasn't so smart, was it? Because he got arrested right away. Here's the evidence right on my face. Just kill someone, come and arrest me. Yeah,
but
so...
when you're facing those kind of people, I mean, I don't know how hard you were when you were doing your dealing stuff. You were dealing with the New Mexican Mafia, which doesn't exactly sound like a tea party in itself, does it?
Well, the rave scene wasn't exactly Scarface. It's people in cuddle puddles, dancing, sniffing Vicks inhalers, smiling, grinning. It wasn't, you know, occasionally there were situations with the Mafia, but that wasn't the general rule. So, you know, I was protected by my bouncers. I was always high and projecting this, you know, powerful persona. But inside, like I mentioned earlier, I was actually this shy, anxious person who was kind of nervous to be around people unless I was high.
Yeah.
Yeah. So going in the jail, cold turkey, being around dangerous people, like inescapably, where you're celled up with them, I credit that now with helping me fix my anxiety. I confronted my fear of being around people. And when I got out of prison, the world just seemed a safe place.
Yeah.
After being in the madhouse. Yeah.
I suppose it's essentially like, oh, your worst nightmares come true, isn't it? The type of pictures that you talk about in your books, the description where you talk about the cockroaches and the food and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But there was, as you say, that kind of key learning lesson where you just thought, I can see here the tunnel of what drug use turns into when you don't nip it in the bud or stop it.
Yeah.
And you're in denial. I mean, do you consider yourself, or did you consider yourself, an addict?
Right. So we would just say we're functional recreational drug users. We go out on the weekend and just party like weekend warriors. We can take a Xanax pill, get back to work. This is never going to catch up with us. We're never going to have any problems. So we're even joking like we were above the law, you know, the police are never going to catch us. And the drugs, what it does is over the years, it scrambles your decision-making processes. So you think all these things are correct in your head, these voices, these thoughts. And actually, you surround yourself with equally insane people and you're all reinforcing each other's negative behaviour. And you're going more and more down that slippery slope and there's nobody to put the brakes on. So yeah, the SWAT team was the wake-up call I needed to snap out of that.
Do you think that saved your life?
Yeah, absolutely. Sammy the Bull Gravano, underboss of the Gambino crime family, was my competition in the ecstasy market. He'd murdered almost 24 people. And his son told me in prison later on, he'd been dispatched one night to kidnap me from a nightclub and take me out to the desert. And the only reason we'd missed him is because my best mate, Wildman, had got in a situation we'd had to leave that club in a hurry. So drugs is telling me, yeah, you're Mr. Cool Guy. This is fun. This is a buzz. You're never going to get caught. You're above the law. But once I sobered up and looked back, I was like, how on earth are you still alive? Yeah.
What were your thoughts on prison, jail and prisoners before you ended up being incarcerated yourself?
Right. I'd seen Shawshank Redemption. What's his name? But Boggs Diamond in the shower. I could be a friend to you. And the sisters, So I was like, you know, thinking that's going to happen to me. I thought it was going to be all serial killers, murderers, rapists, because that's all I'd ever heard in the news. And yeah, they're in prison. They deserve to be in prison. This is what prisons are for. But the vast majority of prisoners, from what I saw, were low-level drug users. The average arrest back then was a black kid or a Mexican for a little bit of weed. Mm-hmm. And researching this now for my War on Drugs series of books, they were arresting almost 1 million people a year in America around that time for weed possession. All about filling these prisons up. Every kid they snatched, the prison got $50,000 of taxpayers' money per year per prisoner. It became one of the highest arrest categories in the history of criminal justice.
Mm. But you actually saw something very different from inside. You saw some quite weak, vulnerable people in society that probably actually needed a bit of love and support, really, rather than punishing. Not everyone would agree, I suppose, but there was an essence that I think you pointed to in one of your books.
In America, prison is the biggest house of the mentally ill. Third of the people I was housed with couldn't even read or write. It was society's most vulnerable people. And hearing the sad stories thrown away by parents, raised on the streets, it opened my heart to what was happening in the world. It made me feel doubly guilty for committing my crimes because I had family support and everything, good education. And these guys didn't have a chance in life, a lot of them. They were born into really horrible circumstances. And what do we do with them? We put them in a jail where we treat them like animals and it's just drug and gang infested mayhem and we expect them to get out and be model citizens and it's a complete disaster for society.
Mm. You mentioned there about your family and that's obviously really important part of your story really and yeah. The support and what's kind of happened since you've come out of jail as well and rebuilding those connections.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, just to explain the situation, because in well, I've got hard time in front of me here, you write, it includes a lot of your letters to your family.
Yeah.
And you're quite upfront and honest, really, about your mum's struggles, the fact that your father, you know, cashes in his retirement fund.
Yeah.
And they remortgage their house to pay for some of your legal fees.
Yeah, it's terrible. When I was doing all my selfish drug behaviour, I thought my parents would never find out. They're 5,000 miles away. I had people with money ready to bail me out if I got in trouble. Police were one step ahead. They arrested me and my mates all on the same day in SWAT team raids. So I was forced then to turn to my parents because in America, your sentence is determined by how much money you've got and who your lawyer is. And I was told I was facing a maximum 200-year sentence. So if I hadn't have got a paid-for lawyer, I'd still be in prison right now. I wouldn't be here talking to you.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm blessed to have such strong family support. Saw so many people disowned by their family members because of their involvement in drugs. And, you know, I tell the young people now, one of the consequences is if you're thinking about going down that road, think about your family because what happened with my mum and dad and sister, you know, with the nervous breakdown with my mum. There was a sensationalist newspaper story about me in a Phoenix New Times, English Sean's Evil Empire. It was 10 pages long. They portrayed me to be a cross between Walter White and a vampire. And it was like everything I did and 10 times more. So I called my aunt in Arizona and said, don't let my mum see this. And she's like, it's too late, there's an internet version. Yeah, so mum read it. She had a nervous breakdown. She was a college teacher and she went into the college and she ran up to some students after reading it, yelling at them, I know you've read the article, I know you know what's going on. So dad had to get her from the college and she's been on off medication to this day. Now, I live south of London and to come up to Manchester, I'm staying at my parents' house presently and it's almost like I can still see that hurt and pain on their faces that I've caused. And people say, Sean, you live this wild and crazy life, is there anything you would change? As well as regretting putting people on the road of drug use that causes harm to so many, I want to take that pain off their faces, but I can't. It makes me sick to my stomach. And that's something I've got to live with for the rest of my life, yeah.
I just want to refer, actually, something that you talk about in your book. You talk about the day in court where your family had to like kind of be references for you.
Yeah.
And it's really emotional, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I was crying and everything.
Your sister had, I mean, your sister is so upset here, and she'd written you this letter. I don't know whether it's before or afterwards, where she'd been to see a counsellor and she'd said how she just got everything out in this letter about how you kind of pushed her aside.
Yeah, yeah.
But then she put that aside and stood in court and gave you the reference that you needed.
Yeah.
Just what was that moment like for you? Because you do say in the book that you broke down. I imagine you must have.
Right, so I'm at the tail end of my remand period, 26 months. I've been fighting this case, the situation, the pressure, the tension has all been getting more intense. Towards the end of it, they tell me I'm facing up to 200 years. I'm at the point now where I'm just about to kill myself because I'm thinking, 200 years in an environment like this, you know, dead rats in the food, cockroaches crawling over me at night times, people getting murdered, people throwing themselves off balconies trying to kill themselves and not even dying, they're just breaking their spines and smashing their legs. People's getting used to the sounds of people's heads getting bashed against the toilets, bodies getting thrown around, seeing people's teeth get knocked out, just seeing blood squirt out of people's heads. You're actually insane by this point. By the time of my sentencing, I was insane. Because of the environment that I'd put myself in. And when they said 200 years, that was it then. I was like, I can't take it anymore. So I was just going to kill myself after a guard did a security walk. Plan to just bleed out. He wouldn't be able to come back and save me if he's just done a security walk. But what stopped me from doing it, I wanted to say goodbye to my family. I had 7 pictures of my mum, dad, girlfriend, sister. And when I mean say goodbye to them, just having a look at these pictures. And that got me crying then as well when I started looking at these pictures, because I'm thinking, my mum's going to get a call saying your son's just slashed his wrists in a foreign jail cell, and I couldn't do it. So the sentencing came in that same year, and my family all wrote letters of support to the judge and flew 5,000 miles and everything. So
I think your dad had said something, hadn't he, during that call?
Yeah, you know, I was blown away by what everybody said, but my dad in particular. He basically said to the judge, he would trade places with me and I wasn't a bad lad and all these things I'd done in my childhood and like good things and stuff like that. And I just felt sick for letting my whole family down.
Yeah.
It was like I was just I was forced to have all of my past, my bad behaviour, just outed in front of everyone in the courtroom, a sterile atmosphere of this courtroom, and my family all there pleading for my sentence not to be so harsh and to have leniency. I know, it was most intense, probably one of the most intense experiences of my life.
Did you think that you deserved it?
Yeah, I absolutely deserved to be punished. It saved my life. It got me off that path of drug abuse, drug dealing and insane behaviour. And because I've got a good education, because I've got strong family support, incarceration became the educational opportunity of a lifetime. I read over 1,000 books in just under 6 years, a lot of the original texts in philosophy and psychology, and they helped me go in deep inside myself and address the root causes of why I got involved in drugs and crime. And there was also a therapist in the prison after the jail who was into neuroscience and Eastern philosophy, and I would go in and discuss all this philosophy and psychology with him, and he helped me build a framework and gave me all these techniques to not be anxious and to get out there and to not go back to that kind of behaviour and to stay in a positive mindset.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think I've heard you say before, actually, with the therapist that you've never spoken to them since, but in some ways you wish that you could say thank you to them.
Yeah, I need to send an email to the Arizona Department of Corrections and find out if he's still there so I can send him a thank you, because I've mentioned him in both of my TED Talks, and I've also mentioned him, I think 10% of my book Prison Time is my sessions with him, actually.
And what's his name?
I probably shouldn't give any names out for legal reasons presently.
But what was it about him that, why did what he say click with you that others hadn't?
It's really unusual, because The medical staff in prison were there, a lot of them, in Arizona at least, because they've been barred from public practice. There's an us versus them mentality between the prisoners and the entire staff. So the prisoner's attitude is, I'm not going to speak to a therapist. That therapist is going to take some notes, put them in a file, and that's going to be used against me. So no one will speak to this guy willingly. But I went in there and spoke to him. And I found that, unlike the other people that I'd spoke to in that department in prison, all the other people just wanted me to take different pills. They were basically experimenting for Big Pharma with the latest generation of psychotropic medication, because prisoners aren't considered human beings. It's institutional use. They can get away with testing things on prisoners. But this therapist, he was against that. He said right away he had a holistic approach. And because I was doing yoga and meditation, we just really clicked. The chemistry was there. And it got to the point, even when, you know, they generally move these people around from time to time. And when he got moved around, I was supposed to put a request in to see him every time. And suddenly, I got the notification that I needed to go see him. I hadn't put a request in. He'd done this for me to come up there so he could say goodbye to me, because he was getting moved to another prison. I think we had about 12 sessions.
Is that all, really?
Yeah, but the knowledge that he imparted was so profound. Like I said, I've been able to parlay it into 2 TED Talks and 10% of prison times.
You probably owe him a check. Let's talk about chess, because a game of chess changed your fortune in prison.
Yeah.
And I do want to know whether you still play chess now. Are you any good still?
Well, I played against Frankie, was the main man I started playing towards the end of my jail time. There was a Russian guy I played earlier on in Hard Time, and I was actually a chess player as a kid. I joined some adults chess club in Widnes in my hometown. So I did start to get some skills going at an early age, but I was quite rusty by the time I got to prison. And that just really helped me pass the time. These Russians are no joke on the chessboard. But, you know, a lot of these Russian mafia guys, they've got like degrees and they're chess players from childhood and really intelligent dudes. So, yeah, building a reputation in the prison chess community kind of helped me fit in. Everyone's looking for ways to fit in so you don't get beaten up.
There was one particular game of chess which changed your fortune, though. We do need to mention this, because it links on then to how you came to be like a biographer. You did your blog and you really found like your voice in writing, but it started from this game of chess, didn't it?
Oh, with Frankie.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I'm at the tail end of my 26 months on remand. I'm in maximum security at this point in time in this jail. So I'm upstairs in the Madison Street Jail. We're all in these cells because it's maximum security lockdown. You don't get out of your cell except for an hour for a shower and a phone call. So as you're walking around the day room on your hour out, you can walk past people's cell doors. You're not supposed to stand there and talk to them. So this guy who looks like Joe Pesci comes up to my cell window. And he said he'd heard I was a chess player and he had a board and everything. And he's just holding it up in front of my window. And he says he wants to play me. And I start playing him. And he just talks a hell of a lot of trash, you know. He's like, booyah, move my pawn up here, eat that motherfucker, I'm going to take your bitch, blah, 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 all the way through it. And he's like proper like gangster guy, all tattooed out, Mexican mafia guy. And, you know, as I got to know him, I found out he was in for murder for hire. He'd already served 29 years when I met him.
Wow.
He was doing a new murder for hire beef, but he beat that charge because all the witnesses disappeared. And he liked me so much, he kind of like vouched for me with some people. And later on, when I was in prison, he caught up with me on another yard and I got in a situation. And he had my back in this really tense situation where an Aryan Brotherhood guy had put out a green light to have me attacked because he didn't like that I was blogging. Yeah. So Frankie stood up for me. Frankie was also bisexual. So he was constantly hitting on me all the way through it. He's like, let's play strip chess, blah, blah, blah. And even to this day, right?
Strip chess. How do you have enough clothes to wear in prison to actually be able to do it?
I know, that's it, isn't it? He just wants to get me naked right away. Yeah, he was a kinky dude.
So your blog, there was an interesting, you know, path to how this ended up being published. But what was the kind of, the moment, really, where you decided, I know what I'm going to do, I'm going to start this blog, to put the pen to paper? Was it a case of boredom, or were you actually quite outraged at what you were seeing?
Okay, so I'm outraged. I've got a rebellious nature. I deserve to be punished, but I'm seeing the injustices of the system all around me. You know, Brian Crenshaw was a partially blind shoplifter. He came in, failed to produce his ID for the evening meal. Guards pulverised him, broke his neck, severe internal injuries. He went into a coma. He died over a month later. Scott Norberg was a mentally ill one they brought in. And they started beating him until his face turned blue. And a female guard said, stop beating him, his face has turned blue. And they kept beating him after he died. And the prisoners were yelling, why are you still beating him? He's already dead. These are mentally ill people. So they did it on camera. Family members sued the jail and got compensation. What do you think the boss of the jail, Sheriff Joe, did to the guards that were found responsible in court for murdering those prisoners?
Well, you would hope that they got sacked and never worked in public service again, but I have a feeling it might be quite different.
Gave them promotions and pay rises.
Really?
So I said to a guard, how do you guys get away with this? You know, the human rights violations, dead rats in the food, cockroaches on us, no recreation, no sunlight or anything. And he said, the world has got no idea what's going on in here. That's how we get away with it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was your door.
Something clicked in my head. Hmm. And my mum was aware of these guys getting murdered in there, so she didn't want us to do it. So that's why we did it under the name John instead of Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Blogs were just starting, really. They weren't that prevalent. There was a blog that had got in the news, Salem Pax, the Baghdad blogger. He'd been blogging as the bombs had been raining down in Iraq. So my dad saw that in the paper and he said, here's an idea to get word out what's going on in there. And then we debated it amongst the family. And because I was in maximum security, I couldn't put these things in the mail because the guards can open the mail.
Mm-hmm.
So my aunt Anne would visit me on the weekends and she smuggled what I wrote out through maximum security.
That must have been quite risky for her. Could she have got in trouble?
Anything can happen in these places.
Hmm.
So she was a very brave woman, yes.
What kind of reaction were you getting from these blogs?
I thought no one would read it, to be honest. And then the BBC ran it and The Guardian ran it. And it just snowballed. And we just got like, it was nearly unanimously, the feedback was like positive. And it was like these people were there with me in spirit then. And it helped me. People wanted to write to me. People wanted to send books. Started filling the prison library up with books. It just made it a different experience. The blog became a bridge to the outside world, not just for me, but also for the other prisoners that I started to write about. And then a community built around the blog. So you're in the jail, you've got all these racial divisions, people are hanging out with their own races. But all of a sudden, you know, I'm writing about T-Bone, this big black guy, I'm writing about two Tonys, Italian mafia mass murderers doing 141 years. I'm writing about She-Ra, my transgender friend, 6.5 foot charismatic transgender friend, who also cut her own testicles off and almost bled to death doing so. Mm. So it's an eclectic mixed race group of people. So it's unusual society that formed around the blog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you called out some really tough situations, like gang rape was something that you tackled.
Oh, God,
and that's such a political thing to do. Did the jail ever speak to you about it? Did they know it was you that was doing it?
No. The jail didn't, the remand jail. But the prison found out after I was sentenced. But they didn't know how to deal with it. They just didn't want me writing anybody's real names or any real situations that could cause a threat to the security institution.
Yeah.
They have subsequently classified it as a threat to the security of the institution and banned everybody from writing to me. But they just send a letter to someone else and then they get forwarded on to me.
Mm.
And the prison rape thing is so common. You've got to go what's called a rape class now to learn how not to get raped.
Wow.
Yeah, and basically, it's a complete waste of time. You go in and watch this video of predators in the day room and they're handing out sweets. Young people come in, whoever takes the sweets are in debt. If you're in debt, can't pay it, sexual favours, you're turned out, you're a prison punk. Rest of your stay, you're sucking dick and cleaning people's toilets once you've been turned out. And the summary of the day was, if you don't want to rape in the prison, if you don't want there to be rape in the prison, you've got to report it. If you report anything, you're a snitch. KOS, kill on sight, the gang rule for reporting anything. So after we all went to this rape class, a young mentally ill prisoner was gang raped and nobody reported anything. Yeah.
One of the tasks that you set yourself in prison was to read 1,000 books.
Yeah.
So you ended up being there for 6 years.
Yeah.
What were some of the books that were you reading? I mean, 1,000 books, are you going right from children's books to like full on, like, you know, massive encyclopedias? Or what kind of things are you talking
about? The only children's book on that entire list is one of my all-time favourites, which is Cat in the Hat. I was at the medical building one day and the Cat in the Hat was there and I read it while I was waiting to go in.
Does that count as one book then?
I did count it as one book, yeah. But you got to balance that with War and Peace by Tolstoy, yes, which is 1,444 pages long.
So what was your favourite?
So War and Peace was my favourite work of classical fiction. So I've got different categories for my favourites.
Yeah.
Contemporary fiction, Tutone is the Italian mafia guy who started protecting me because I wrote his life story. He introduced me to Tom Wolfe, John Updike, Norman Mailer. My parents had just sent me some Stephen King.
Yeah.
And he gets it and he's like, Sean, what are you reading this for? Stephen King's churning out books like McDonald's is churning out hamburgers. I'm not saying it's not a bad thing to have a hamburger once in a while, but let me get you something a bit more refined. I'm the kind of guy who likes some ravioli and spinach, and you know, then he gets into his Italian.
And remind us what Tutone's is in for again.
So Tutone's has left the dead bodies of rival gangsters from Arizona to Alaska. He was doing 141 years.
And so he's recommending you a rather refined set of books. Okay.
Self-taught in prison, self-educated, natural philosopher. An amazing person to meet. There's a hierarchy amongst the murderers. If you've only murdered rival gangsters, you're top of the respect in the prison. If you've murdered a woman or a child, it's KOS. Prisoners try and kill those guys when they come in. So I got in a situation where I got attacked and Tutone's ended up protecting me after that. And then I wrote his life story. So we became really close. And by the time I was getting released, that was another teary-eyed moment when we were saying goodbye. He said I was like the son that he'd never had.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So he comes in with Norman Mailer, John Updike, Tom Wolfe. And both of our contemporary favourite fiction was written by Tom Wolfe. And my favourite is A Man in Full.
Okay.
Yeah. Other stuff.
What are your other categories? Just tell us your categories.
Philosophy.
Right.
Psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Short stories. My favourite short stories. Anton Chekhov. I got obsessed with the Russians for a while. Chekhov, he'll write about two drunken peasants. Nothing happens. There's no plot. There's no structure. But you read these stories and you come away with goosebumps. And this magical feeling because he writes in the most beautiful way ever. Chekhov does, yeah. He's absolutely so talented. Philosophy, got obsessed with Plato's Republic, got obsessed with Nietzsche, the Stoics, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius. And then philosophy, you know, a lot of names kept coming up in these various books I was reading, like Freud, Jung, Erickson, Fromm. I thought, I'm sick of their names coming out and reading interpretations of what they said. I best go back and read all the original texts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. And I was surprised, you know, that people just put their own spin on all of these great authors. So it's good to go back and read the original text and put it in the context of what you're doing and taking things that can help you in your life, which is what I was able to do with the help of the therapist.
Mm.
It's good to read this stuff, but how can you apply it to your life? And now, how can you go out there and talk about these things and pass it on to other people?
Yeah. You have a talk, don't you, called Life Lessons?
Yeah.
And is that where you've kind of pulled in all this information that you kind of inhaled, really, and soaked in like a sponge over that time when you had all that time to read and think and ponder about life?
Absolutely. I think it would have happened naturally anyway that I would have progressed to teaching life lessons. But what accelerated it was when my Bang the Report episode was broadcast worldwide, a publisher out of Canada saw it in his country and he contacted me and he said, there's loads of personal development and self-help books out there. Most of them are phonies. These guys have never been through any real experiences in their lives. He said, you've been through some real hardcore stuff, which is authentic. And I think I could market a book about your 10 most important life lessons. Mm-hmm. So I sat around with my family and we discussed it and we came up with 10 things. And I put a little book together on life lessons. And then that morphed into me doing a life lessons talk to the school kids. Mm-hmm. And I also now do that talk to adults as well.
Yeah. One of the things that comes up in your life lessons is your love life. And yeah. It's been a bit up and down. That's to say the least, isn't it? You know, I don't know whether this is still up to date, but it had that you were married 3 times.
Yes.
Those marriages seemed pretty up and down, from drug addicts to domestic violence to all kinds of things.
I was wild back then, so I was attracting women equally wild.
Yeah.
And I got in a situation with my first wife, who was mentally ill, we just got married. And she jumped in the shower one night, bust the shower curtain open with a Ginsu knife, going to slash my man parts off. And I thought, we've just got married, someone's got an issue, you need to stay with them. And it was a big mistake. It just got worse and worse.
Yeah.
This was a point in my life where I'd stopped taking drugs. I thought I was married and settled down. That was it. I was going to have a happy ever after.
Yeah.
The volatility of being with this woman set me off again. My own daft fault for staying with her. And as the stress built, I started craving that feeling of...
But you were a victim, though. That is essentially like a domestic violence victim.
I know, but...
Men can be victims too, can't they?
Which was quite embarrassing, yeah, for me when I got told that. But I chose to stay with her, didn't I? When I knew what...
So do a lot of victims.
It is a cycle. You think it's just... It's because it's happened and it's not happening again. And it happens again and again and again. That's it, yeah.
So now with your kind of hindsight, and now you're older and wiser,
yeah.
Can you see that there was a cycle there, or was there something within yourself that you go talk about your anxieties with the fact that some of these relationships that weren't women that were necessarily right for you or your situation? Is that something that you kind of put as a lesson later on now?
All the things that have happened in my life are an externalization of an inner chaos that I've had to learn to tame.
Mm-hmm.
And in party time, I describe it as my wolves. You know, the stress goes up a little bit and I feel these wolves howling and I get that goose fleshy feeling howling for me to go back out into the party scene and do these drugs and run around at raves and stuff and behave insanely. So I was forced to cage my inner wolves with the help of the therapist and the help of all this psychology and philosophy. And I still feel they're in me, but they're caged, pacing from side to side perhaps.
Yeah.
But they're secure.
Yeah.
So that was a huge lesson for me to learn. If you've got an adrenaline junkie, risk-taking, addictive personality like me, the key is to trigger that cascade of endorphins by channeling your energy into positive addictions. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand you could just take that energy and put it into martial arts, public speaking, dancing, sports, all these things that cause that endorphin release. And then you're not going to get a visit from a SWAT team. I was put into things that could put me away for the rest of my life.
Mm.
Yeah.
And being with people that weren't right for you, I suppose, you know.
Yeah.
Just mention the stories for your second and third marriage. I suppose we should...
Second one wasn't a traditional marriage at a court procedure. It was... She collected serial killer books and she was obsessed with serial killers and she liked the movie Natural Born Killers. So we went to a new age area in Arizona called Sedona and she just pulls out a blade and slashes our hands and commingles the blood. She was a former Calvin Klein model who'd got in a car crash, got addicted to painkillers, and then got addicted to crystal meth. And she was packing a handgun when I met her. And I'm thinking, this is cool. I remember I went over to her house early on. She had a waterbed and she couldn't move it. So she pulls out the gun and shoots the waterbed. We'd be coming home from rage. She just starts shooting the gun out of the car at the sky. Yeah. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm like a character in Pulp Fiction now. This is so cool. Because the drugs are telling me this.
So then the third wife must have been better.
Third wife. Oh, my God. So I probably had the wildest time of my life with this woman. She was bisexual. She'd done chemistry and something else at university, but she was doing lesbian internet porn when I met her. Mm. So we got married on the Las Vegas Strip, and it got completely out of control. She lost her mind on drugs, got this idea to kill herself in the manner of Cleopatra, flew to Egypt on a one-way ticket, couldn't find a snake, so she made a weapon out of a Mark razor and took a bunch of prescription pills and slashed her wrists.
Wow.
Yeah. But she was rescued, and she went on to be a school teacher in China, and she's a school teacher right now in Africa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So you've met some people in your time. That's one for sure, isn't it? Gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Then you went on to have a completely, what sounded like, quite normal relationship. You got out of drugs. And then when you got arrested, you were with someone who basically kept you going for a long time.
I stopped dealing, but I couldn't quit taking drugs.
Mm.
On the weekends, I split my life between telling her to stay in on the weekends and going out with my party friends and getting high.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the police caught me, because they caught some phone calls around that period of time. I didn't have a phone. I just used payphones, but other people did. And they caught me talking about personal use. I never got caught saying anything on the major transactions. And I thought, I'd quit dealing so they can't do anything. They've got to catch you with the drugs. I didn't understand Arizona law, statute of limitations. If you have sold drugs to someone in your past and they go and tell the police, they've got a witness. They don't need the drugs. All they need is a witness right. from your past. So that was it. Yeah, they had 10 witnesses and that's how I got arrested.
Mm. But having somebody, your girlfriend, whilst you were in jail, and you actually proposed to her whilst you were in jail as well, that must have been good, but also not so good. There must have been ups and downs that came with that. But why propose to someone when you're in that situation? Is that because you thought you were going to get out?
Oh, it was intense, you know. She was like the golden-hearted woman I'd looked for my entire life. She wasn't a nutter like I was a nutter, attracting nutters. And it seemed like she was really the right person to, like, get married and have kids with. And perhaps it was naive. And it was, in the end, I figured out it was actually selfish, because wanting her to stay with me and suffer for my wrongdoing, which is ended up what happening, was putting her through hell. So when she did break up with me, even though I wanted to fight to have her back, in my heart, I knew the right thing was, if I loved her, was to let her go.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking what you've been in jail for, what, 2 years at this point?
Yeah.
She'd also taken charges, you know, because she was connected to you.
Prosecutor knew she was my lifeline, visiting me 3 times a week. So they charged her with a couple of prescription pills, found in our house on the day of the SWAT team raid a year earlier, that didn't have a written prescription right next to them, which is a class 6 felony.
Mm.
Visitors can't visit co-defendants. So when she became my co-defendant, she could no longer visit me. It was all about breaking me down psychologically. They criminalised her.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's skip to the day that you were released.
Okay.
What happened and what was that like? Was it emotional?
It was a protracted process, because when I was released from prison, I was then released to a deportation camp where I had to wait for an unknown date to arise for security purposes. I couldn't be told it to get on my flight back to the UK. So I'm in this deportation camp for a couple of weeks and they tell me, roll your stuff up, you're going. But then it wasn't as simple as just getting on a plane either. Have you seen that movie Con Air with Nicolas Cage?
haven't actually.
Connor, all the prisoners are on a plane. Federal marshals are guarding them. You're all shackled up. You can't have a pee or get up or anything. So I was on Connor then for a couple of days, going across Arizona and California, just picking up and dropping off Mexicans. Because it was deportation, I was the only English guy. I spoke a bit of English, a bit of Spanish by then, so I was able to communicate stuff for the Mexicans to the guards. In the end, after 2 days of that, I got put on a flight from LA to London. This is the point now where they're taking the handcuffs off me. They say, we're going to put you on the flight first, before the passengers come, so you don't scare the passengers with your cuffs and all that. Don't try anything funny. So I walk up those stairs to this plane, and there's like a Cockney cabin crew. And it was the first time anyone spoke to me like I was a human being.
Really?
I was just blown away by, I couldn't understand why they weren't talking to me like I was an animal. I was really sensitive. I got on the plane, all the people get on, smell the women's perfume and stuff after being around sweaty, hairy men for 6 years. But I'm institutionalised, so I'm thinking I probably stink because I've been in transportation for a couple of days in the desert. I need to take a bird bath. But to go to the bathroom, I need to ask permission. So I put my hand up in front of everyone and ask a female member of the cabin crew permission to go to the bathroom. And she's like, you don't need to ask, it's right there. And I'm getting all embarrassed now, thinking people are looking at me. So I went and had a bird bath and come back. And I haven't slept in days and I'm still so excited, I can't sleep. And I'm just on this flight. It was quite smooth, actually. And we got to Gatwick. There's videos of it on my YouTube channel of me all stubbled out. Look like I've come out of some kind of situation. My eyes are a bit like, ooh. And mum's there, dad's there, sister's there, mum and sister crying, and we're just giving them hugs. And there's also a video of me driving back from the airport to my sister's flat in Fulham. And my sister showed me a smartphone and about texting.
Well, you hadn't seen one.
I'd banned phones because of the nature of my business. Mm. Some of my mates did have phones and stuff. But when I went in May 16th, 2002, by then I hadn't used the smartphone in its proper capacity or anything because of my drug deal. I didn't want the police to be able to track me.
Mm.
So when I got out, and it's like texting and everything. That was like, I was oblivious to it, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
What about your family? So what year did you get out?
December 2007. It's just gone my 10-year anniversary last December.
So how are things with your family?
Oh, it's good now because they see the good work I'm doing in the schools. They see all the feedback from the kids. They've come to some of my talks. And they've seen the responses and the impact. And, you know, kids send me feedback on Twitter. It's all live feedback from all my likes. But sometimes I get parents requesting to meet me as well. One student, she saw my talk. She was so inspired, she went to do a degree at Winchester University in criminology.
Mm-hmm.
And her family are thinking about going out, flying out to Arizona and visiting one of my prison mates, T-Bone. Yeah, wow. So it has these knock-on effects. You never know what's going to happen when you speak to an audience, you know, how it's going to get carried forward.
Yeah, yeah.
By the people. So they see that I've not gone back to drugs in the 10 years I've been out. They were worried about me going back at first, because most prisoners do, from what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw I'm doing well with all my books as well. I've got 8 books out now, got my own publishing company, and written these books about Pablo Escobar, which have been bestsellers on Amazon.
See, because I asked you earlier, did you deserve it when it came to the punishment?
Yeah.
But are you at a point now where you feel that you deserve their love and their support, and that you think of yourself in a better, more positive light?
Well, I wouldn't go and say I deserve anyone's love and support. I would say I'm hopeful for people's love and support.
Because you're a big believer in karma,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. All I can do is behave the way I can behave and try and set a good example and be a positive person. And if people want to get drawn into that light and choose to love and support me, that's their decision.
Mm.
Yeah.
Has there been temptations along the way over the past 10 years?
No. I think I was so in shock at going into an environment where people are getting murdered and getting pushed to the brink of suicidal insanity. It was like I had a pressure on my brain, a clamp, That 26 months on remand, I credit that increasing pressure tightening every month. Prosecutors saying you're never going to get out towards the end of it. I credit that now with forcing me to change, because if I had got released in my first year, I was still wild. I would have gone back to taking drugs on the weekend at a minimum, possibly even going back to dealing again.
Mm.
When you are facing 200 years, your million-dollar house on the mountain and your sports car and your swimming pool and all your gadgets don't matter anymore. And I saw Wall Street as a kid. Greed is good. And that became my motto. And that got crushed out of me when I was at the verge of killing myself. Getting sentenced to 9.5 years was one of the happiest days of my life, because I could see exactly when I was going to get my life back. I could start to plan again after thinking I was never, ever going to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's transformed my worldview. I don't feel now the need to go back to drugs. I mentioned about my anxiety. If you're happy in your own skin, you don't feel the need to change your brain into a way that, you know, like people say, I need to have a glass of wine to feel more relaxed. I don't even drink alcohol or anything like that. I could get up in front of audiences, and that helps that part of me that likes that adrenaline rush.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all these positive things now I've learned to channel my energy into, to not go back to it. And people say, Sean, were you a drug addict? And I say, I had a relationship with drugs. I hear Russell Brand say, I'm a drug addict. If I drink, my guard will be lowered. Next thing, I'll be smoking crack. I don't feel that that would ever happen to me. I can't classify myself as that kind of person. I had a relationship with drugs. I've learned about how drugs work on me, and I'm finished with them.
Mm.
You know, I can't see anything that would happen in my life that would make me want to go back to it.
So if you were your older, wiser self now,
yeah,
a whispering voice speaking to yourself,
yeah,
on Oldham Street, just around the corner from where we are right now, how ironic is this?
Yeah.
What would you say to that teenager right now?
Most teenagers experiment with drugs, about half of them, but some of them have got addictive tendencies, and they're the ones who are at risk and self-destruct. Apparently, I'm one of them, so I would point that out. I'd also point out that if you stay on a trajectory of slow and steady progress in the stock market or whatever your goal is in life, you're going to achieve a massive success. And that's what you want, really, is to have this massive success at that age in life. As a young lad, I did anyway. I define success by having, you know, success in the stock market. I don't define that success as that now. But I would say if that's what you want, you want to be huge in some profession, just stay on the path of slow and steady progress. Because when I saw the fast cash and the excitement from dealing, and I made that decision, it cost me everything. I was worth $2 million in the stock market. Didn't even need to be getting involved in drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be worth $10 million right now if I'd have stayed on that slow and steady progress in the stock market instead of having to rebuild my life from scratch.
So what about the future then? Do you think, are there any kind of big decisions that you're pondering over? Any future fuck it moments, do you think?
I don't put that pressure on myself anymore to, like, be huge in anything like I used to. And I already anticipate that I'll exceed my previous successes, but I'm not putting the pressure on me to get there with any particular time frame or anything like that. I can see the way it's going now, with the books being bestsellers and the new books I've got coming out this year. Most of my sales have come from interest in Pablo Escobar, and I've written my Pablo Escobar book based on everything that's available in the English-speaking world.
Mm-hmm.
So now I've paid to get Spanish-speaking world stuff translated, and that's where there's a hell of a lot more stuff about Pablo. So this year I hope to publish a 200,000-word book about Pablo, the most comprehensive book about him ever written.
Mm-hmm.
I think that will be unique, and I think that will take my sales to a whole new level. That's more money for cannabis shows then.
Well, it's definitely been really entertaining talking to you, Sean. I mean, what a story, what a journey. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on your podcast, Claire. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a Small Furry Bear production. There's more details of the podcast and media consultancy at asfbproductions.com. It's hosted and presented by me, Claire Freeman. The music is by Thomas Ragsdale. You can find out more about FinPod. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook. And if you've got a story to share, email us finpod@gmail.com. Next week, we meet Jeffrey. Jeffrey's someone who I met in a coffee shop, but he's facing a huge dilemma and a massive fuck-it moment in his life. It's all because the last 8 years, frankly, have been a blur. He's been waiting for his wife to die. She's been battling with terminal cancer. Now he's deciding what 2018 and the rest of his life will look like. We share details and he's pretty open and honest with me about what to expect and what's to come in the next few months of his life. Hit subscribe and follow us on social media to find out what happens next on the Fuck It Moments podcast. Mm-hmm.